This week's program, a conversation with Ted Lewis, the new president and CEO of the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts. Susan Lewis looks ahead to performances of Handel's Messiah. In our continuing series of what it takes to bring theater to life, Jason Pfeiffer looks at the role of the stage manager. And David Patrick Stearns profiles Jan Vogler. The much-talked-about cellist is about to make his Philadelphia debut. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts is America's oldest art school. Founded in 1805 by the artist and scientist Charles Wilson Peale and the sculptor William Rush. Its alumni include Thomas Aikens, Maxfield Parrish, William Glackens, Violet Oakley, Henry Osawa Tanner, the filmmaker David Lynch, and the architect Louis I. Kahn. PAFA has one of the world's finest collections of American art, housed in the Frank Furness-designed Victorian Gallery on North Broad Street, and now also next door at the Samuel M.V. Hamilton Building, a 300,000-square-foot, 11-storey former industrial facility that was renovated and reopened last year as an exhibition, studio, administration and teaching space. It's been 1 month since Ted Lewis took charge of the Academy. His appointment came almost a year after the previous president, Derek Gilman, left to head up the Barnes Foundation. Prior to becoming president of PAFA, Lewis spent 10 years as a consultant in the academic field. From 1983 to 1996, he was president of St. Mary's, the liberal arts college in southern Maryland, and before that he was associate dean of Cornell University's Graduate School of Business. When we met earlier this week, I first asked him what had convinced him to give up consulting and return to a more fixed position.
Well, consulting is fascinating, but what's missing from it is, although you give a lot of good advice, you think, you don't stay at the institution to see if what you're recommending is implemented, and it doesn't give you the satisfaction and the enormous kind of high that you get when you really do help build an institution and help shape an institution.
And why this institution then in particular?
Because I had never done it before. When I left St. Mary's many years ago, I had a lot of offers from liberal arts colleges for in terms of a presidency, but I had no interest in doing a second presidency of a liberal arts college. And I think there's always a danger in a college president or a university president to begin to define themselves as simply that. But beyond that, you know, an art school was new, a museum is new, it was a new world. Although I'm not an artist, I certainly have sat on the edge of that world for a long time and have been fascinated by it. So this was something that really interested me. And what has happened here in the last 7 to 8 years is really quite remarkable. And it's always fun to come to an institution with this great momentum and the promise of things that you can do, and the future is there.
That said, is it your view that this is an art school with a great museum, or a great museum attached to an art school?
I think it's both, and I think at times in the past it might have been an art school and a museum, but I think I'm working very hard. David Brigham, who is the new director of the museum, and Jeff Carr, who is the dean of academic affairs, we're all really working now to find shared agendas where we really can knit the two together the way they should be knit together. Because it's an enormous advantage for students, for example, to have this museum with the third best collection of American art in the world right next door. It has to be both. We are one institution. That's why they call us an academy. And I think we're really committed to making that work.
The Academy recently celebrated its bicentennial.
Yes.
You will now become a part of what people will look back on in 50 or 100 or even 200 years' time. When you stepped into this wonderful corner office a month ago,
yes,
did you in your mind have a vision for what you want PAFA to do under your leadership?
Sure. I think on the museum side, we need to do shows that have national visibility. We need to do shows or exhibitions that will travel because they're so good that we'll travel to other museums. So that's one area. We need to do, and we're in the process of planning, symposia that will touch on the history and the trends in American art. On the school side, we hope we will soon have approved our BFA program. We're going to be looking at programs in museum studies at the MA level. We are going to make a consistent effort to enlarge the profile of both the museum and the school. I mean, one of the shocking things is this school, which is the oldest art school in the country, and this great museum, which is, again, one of the oldest museums in the country with this extraordinary collection, many people don't know about it, and many people even in Philadelphia don't know about it. And that's our responsibility. So part of any job for a college or a university or for the academy is marketing, and I mean that in the best sense, telling the story of the institution, the story that needs to be told. And we're going to work very hard at that.
The new president and CEO of the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts, Ted Lewis. It's December, and in Philadelphia, several messiahs are coming to town. Handel's Messiah, that is. This 18th century oratorio, originally composed for performance during the springtime Christian observance of Lent, has become a contemporary staple of Christmas celebrations in modern America. Now, WRTI's Susan Lewis explores the magnetism and majesty of Handel's Messiah.
It was 1741, and the noted opera composer, George Friedrich Handel, was facing an uncertain future in his adopted home of England. English musical tastes were changing, and Handel was in debt. Then came an invitation from the Lord Lieutenant of Ireland to stage concerts in Dublin. Thinking of a musical form that could be performed during Lent when theatrical productions were not permitted, Handel turned from opera to another increasingly popular style of musical storytelling.
He really invented what we think of now as the oratorio.
David Hayes is the music director of the Philadelphia Singers, now the resident chorus of the Philadelphia Orchestra, which is performing Handel's Messiah this month. Although there were oratorios written before Handel's time, it was a relatively new form in England, and Handel put his mark on it.
He took older forms, the Roman oratorio, the English mass, the English church anthem, and he combined elements of all of those things to create a large-scale dramatic work based on biblical texts so nobody could complain during Lent, and a greater role for the chorus than would be in an opera performance. He did these performances and could do them because he wasn't using stage scenery or props or anything.
Opera, which does use scenery and props, had been Handel's first musical love. Born in Germany in 1685, about a month before Johann Sebastian Bach, Handel wrote his first opera before he was 20 years old. Shortly afterwards, he moved to Italy, where he soaked up the Italian way of writing for the voice. In his late 20s, he went to England, first to stage an opera, then to work for the monarchy. Steve Zone, associate professor of music history at Temple University, says after the young composer moved to England permanently, he dominated the musical scene there.
It was sort of the perfect storm for Handel. He could set himself up as an Italian opera composer, which was what he was mostly interested in, but he also had an opportunity to write sacred vocal music, which he had experience with for the monarchy. It was a great publishing scene. He could get his music published. So there were a lot of opportunities for him.
He was quite prolific and could work very quickly.
There was really very little concept of spending as much time as it took because it just had to be as good as possible. Opening night was in 3 weeks, and you had to have it regardless of how good it was. There was no real conception of creating a lasting masterpiece for posterity.
In 1741, at age 56, Handel spent 24 days creating Messiah. Its first performance was during Lent on Fishamble Street in Dublin on April 13th, 1742. Charles Jennens created a libretto that was not a typical sacred text.
Every valley, shall be exalted.
It's from the Old Testament. It's from the New Testament. It's a phrase of one piece in one book that's attached to another phrase in another book, and yet his librettist somehow managed to create the sense that this was the story as it's laid out. It's a brilliant libretto in the sense that you never feel it's a patchwork.
To this text, Handel put notes that often musically describe the words. There is a lot of text painting, says Yale music professor and artistic director of Singing City, Jeffrey Brillhart.
The crooked shall be made straight, so the line is very crooked, if you will. And then when you get to the word straight, the voice just stops and holds the note. It's kind of a funny moment.
The crooked straight, and the rough place is great.
However quickly put together, however unorthodox its narrative form, Handel's Messiah became a much-performed piece, even in Handel's day. David Hayes says each time Handel did it, he changed it a bit.
Handel himself never actually settled on a final version, and he was constantly changing it and adjusting it, particularly in the area of soloists. He would rewrite arias, change keys, shorten them, lengthen them, eliminate them, do all sorts of manipulations according to who he had available for the soloists in any given year or any given run of performances.
During the first London performance at Covent Garden in 1743, King George II reportedly stood during the Hallelujah Chorus. No one knows for sure why, but people have been standing for that movement ever since.
Hallelujah! 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 Hallelujah!
The Hallelujah Chorus is something that you always teach in a chorus, and not because it's so famous. It's sort of a masterpiece of manipulating musical texture. So there's melody and accompaniment. There's very intricate fugal writing. There's everything in between. And all of this happens in the space of just a couple minutes.
So began the evolution of the work that lives on today, an oratorio that tells, without specific characters, the story of the Christ in three parts, the birth, the passion, and the aftermath. It's still performed in different versions, with different instrumentation and different solo parts, although the choral sections remain pretty much the same. The way it's performed depends on conductor, who will be playing what instruments, and who will be singing, on stage and off. Sometime in the last century, the audience got in on the act. This year, Singing City is performing its second annual Sing-Along Messiah. Kimmel Center Vice President of Programming Mervon Mehta says last year about 1,200 people came.
When I looked around the room, most people actually didn't have scores because they knew it by heart.
This year, Singing City will be joined by two high school choirs and accompanied by organist Nathan Lauba. Open seating will allow audience members to sit by voice part if they choose.
And some people like to do that, and some people really hate doing that. They like to stay with their partners or their group. Whatever way you want to do it is fine. We're not trying to make an artistic statement here. We're trying to make a community statement.
Despite its roots in the Bible, Handel's Messiah taps into emotions not limited to one faith, feelings that don't grow stale over time.
There's a universality to the piece that appeals to Christians and to Jews and to atheists even. There's such a spirit of hopefulness about it.
Maybe this is another reason Messiah is performed at Christmas. It's a challenging and familiar, complex and compelling work of art that people can relate to on many levels. A spirit of hopefulness isn't bad at any time, but in the darkness of winter, it's a welcome shining light.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Singing City Choir will be joined by the Northeast High School Concert Choir and Upper Derby High School Encore Singers in its second annual Sing Along Messiah this Friday. The Philadelphia Singers perform Messiah in concert with the Philadelphia Orchestra on December 16th. Both events are at the Kimmel Center in Philadelphia. When we go to the theater, the action on stage is generally of most interest to us, but behind every show is a flurry of activity out of sight from the audience. Costume dressers, stagehands, lighting and soundboard operators all work together to support the work of the actors and ensure the show runs smoothly. And at the helm of all this is the stage manager. Now, as part of our continuing series on what it takes to bring theatre to life, WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer explores the role of the stage manager.
You might not even realize that they're there, perched behind or perhaps to the side of an audience. A stage manager runs the show from what might be thought of as the command center, giving the signal for each scene change, lighting transition, or sound effect.
Go.
Lights 8.5, standby sound E and Q light off. Lights 8,
go.
Seated in a dimly lit booth overlooking an Arden Theater audience in Philadelphia, Pat Sabato calls out cues over a radio headset for a performance of An Empty Plate in the Café du Grand Bouff. Sabato has been stage managing at the Arden for about 10 years, yet she doesn't take part in every show there. Although some theaters have resident stage managers who do manage all productions, Sabato says many companies hire different stage managers from show to show, the same way actors are cast and many other positions in a production are filled.
You want to get the right designer, you want to get the right director, the right stage manager, because it impacts on how well the end product comes together. It's a good recipe. You know, if you mix the right ingredients together, you're going to get a really good product.
Bringing the right mix of people together for a show certainly, in part, determines the success or failure of a play. But having the right stage manager in place is essential for a smoothly run production, according to Lori Agazarian, one of two stage managers at the Walnut Street Theater in Philadelphia.
In a nutshell, I am the communications hub between all the different departments that are involved in putting a production together. I'm the liaison between the designers and the director and the actors and the stagehands. It's basically making sure everybody knows everything they need to know.
While the gathering and dissemination of information helps explain the overall function of a stage manager, it doesn't adequately describe all aspects of the job. The stage manager's job starts long before performances of a show begin. The work commences with rehearsal preparation, working alongside the director to organize schedules, keeping detailed records of the direction assigned to actors and designers, compiling a list of needed props, following along in the scripts in case an actor needs a line prompt, making sure the actors get breaks. Another major task for a stage manager is creating a callbook, which is basically a script of the play with each technical cue of the show notated in the margins. Pat Sabato of the Arden Theater explains that considering all these responsibilities, it's entirely necessary for a stage manager to be in rehearsals from day one.
I help build a machine, and then I drive it. I'm not the one who makes the decisions about how it's going to be. But I watch how the mechanics work together so that I can maintain it.
Once the play's blueprint is locked in place and the show opens, a director's job is essentially done. At this point, the stage manager takes charge of the production. In some cases, a director may be on staff with the theater and remain around to keep an eye on the show, but often a director leaves entirely once a show is open, and maintenance of the artistic aesthetics are left to the stage manager. Here, says Pat Adams, who's been the Wilma Theater's stage manager since 1996, is where a keen understanding of a director's intentions in all areas is crucial.
To a certain extent, during the course of the run, a play can grow. It can change slightly. Sometimes growth can be in the right direction based on what you've rehearsed and what's been talked about in rehearsal. Sometimes it grows the other way. It is a stage manager's job to keep it all under control.
After opening, keeping the show running smoothly and under control extends beyond sitting in a booth and calling the show on a daily basis. It also means having interaction with the administrative staff, actors, and stage crew. For example, shortly before an Arden Theater show begins, Pat Sabato might be found backstage by the dressing rooms, chatting with stagehands and actors and keeping them posted as to how soon the audience will be seated and ready for the performance.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're at Places, Please. Places. See you on the other side of the light. Have a wonderful show, guys.
Thank you,
good show.
As the conduit for communication in a setting with, well, a lot of egos, it's good for a stage manager to have an abundant supply of patience, tact, and solid interpersonal skills. The Walnut Street Theater's Lori Agazarian says a thick skin is also needed, as one who needs to enforce rules and policies.
You're a cheerleader and the teacher and the disciplinarian. I mean, I have to discipline people. And at the same time, I'm handing them a Band-Aid and a Ricola and taking their used tissue out of their hand. And that's all part of my job.
Or another way to put it, according to Pat Sabato of the Arden, is that the job is a lot like parenting. She says the best training she's had for her work was being a mother.
It's a lot of the same skills. While I'm not comparing actors to children, getting people prepared to go out and do what they have to do, making sure they have everything they need and they have the right attitude for it And building that spirit of ensemble comes from, you know, being able to keep your family running.
Though perhaps one of the less glamorous roles in a theater company, the stage manager is the lifeline for all the elements that come together in theater. In view of the complexity of the different parts, both the technical and human components, that person seated in the booth behind the audience, talking into a headset, is one manager that's indispensable.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. The German cellist Jan Vogler last performed in Philadelphia some 15 years ago as one of many in those periodic Musicians from Marlborough concerts at the Seaport Museum. Now at age 42, he returns, this time to the Kimmel Center, playing C.P.E. Bach with the Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia. Now Philadelphia Inquirer classical music journalist David Patrick Stearns has a profile of one of the more strong-minded cello soloists on today's concert circuit.
Jan Vogler came to international attention in the single most competitive corner of the cello repertoire, the Dvorak Cello Concerto. His recording is known as one of the toughest, with something distinctive to say.
I really started some research and I found my own approach with the Dvorak. And I do think that this recording of the Dvorak with the New York Phil and David Robertson is something at least which could enlarge the field we are talking about. And there was definitely one angle which I wanted to approach very much, which was the Dvorak Concerto as an American piece. We all know that Dvorak had lots of anxieties in New York. He was very, very scared of that big city and scared to go on the streets, scared of the noises, scared of the amount of people, what all these things. Those facts we know. But then, if we look deeper into it, we can also see that in this piece, it isn't that same sentimental mood we find in many other pieces which were written in Bohemia. And I think there is some struggle in this piece, emotional struggle, which isn't necessarily sentimental, but it's more rhythmical fire, rhythmical emotion, I think.
Perhaps no major cellist has a musical pedigree that encompasses such opposite extremes. Vogler grew up in the former East Germany. He recalls that there were few movies, not even bowling, but a lot of theater and concerts and much philosophical arguing about German writers like Hermann Hesse and Stefan Zweig. At age 20, he became principal cellist of the tradition laden Dresden Staatskapelle.
That was a very important time for me. I would definitely not be a soloist now if I wouldn't have had that time. It's impossible with our repertoire to really understand music if you only study that cello repertoire. It is too isolated. And for me, I think that time saved me from a crisis, I think, because it was really another world of study, another school in a way. So I wasn't thrown into the market like many, many other colleagues of mine who just finish studying and they play their instruments well and they start playing concerts all over. And I think that is very hard.
As East Germany opened up to the rest of the world, Vogler began spending summers at the Marlborough Music School. And what a different world that was. The repertoire, the starry instructors, the parties. It was also there that he met his wife, Mira. They eventually settled in New York City with their two children, with frequent return visits to Dresden. Vogler also formed a chamber music duo with Canadian pianist Louis Lorty. Together, they give a Philadelphia Chamber Music Society recital here in the spring. If there's a consistent artistic compass in his life, it's inspiration from singers. That's the case with most serious string players, in a lifelong effort to make human sounds from what is essentially a piece of wood. When younger, Vogler was exhorted by his teachers to think about Luciano Pavarotti when playing big-gestured works such as Shlomo by Ernst Bloch. His own taste runs more towards word-based singers, such as Fritz Wunderlich and Elizabeth Schwarzkopf. But it's an ambivalent relationship. While assembling his recent disc of cello encores, titled My Tunes, he played a transcription of the Bach cantata Ich habe genug, realizing his performance only made sense when disregarding the words about facing death with resignation. The album ends with Moon River. I wonder if you could possibly forget the words to that.
First of all, that movie already is unbelievable, Breakfast Tiffany's. In every aspect, the story, the philosophy behind it, the time when it was made, and if we look at America at the time and then we look at this incredible story and the music. Mancini, I mean, I think half of the movie is the music. It's expressed through this fantastic score. And when Audrey Hepburn sings Moon River, then it's very hard to forget that. I mean, that's just a pretty unbelievable moment.
So Vogler's relationship with the voice is complicated. When he listens to a singer, he hears rather different things from the typical music lover. One of his chief sources of inspiration is Jessie Norman in her recording of Strauss's Four Last Songs.
That one song is probably the most single most perfect instrumental piece in the world. Although it's sung. You know everything about shifting on a string instrument, you know everything about phrasing, everything about subito pianos, and everything about arching and architecture in a phrase. It's unbelievable. When I'm a little bit depressed or a little bit exhausted, I listen to this one song and I completely back to life, completely.
Philadelphia Inquirer classical music journalist David Patrick Stearns. Jan Vogler is the soloist for two concerts with the Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia at the Kimmel Center's Parliament Theater tomorrow afternoon at 2:30 and on Monday evening at 7:30. Vogler's latest CD is Concerti Brillanti, and David Patrick Stearns writes about Jan Vogler in tomorrow's Philadelphia Inquirer. And that's our show. Our thanks this week to Beth Yeagle, Tom Miller, and Gigi Lam. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.